WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Father Neil O'Brien. 3 years ago, he was expelled from the Philippines, where he had worked for 20 years as a Columban missionary priest. O'Brien, who grew up in South Dublin, worked with the poor on the island of Negros, where virtually the only paid work was on the sugar plantations. In Negros, O'Brien took a strong stand for human rights and nonviolence, and he organized a network of Christian communities which condemned torture, militarism, and the exploitation of the poor. The Marcos regime considered these communities subversive. In 1973, O'Brien was arrested along with two other priests and six lay leaders on trumped-up charges that they murdered a local mayor and his companions. After over a year in prison, O'Brien was released on the condition that he leave the country. He went to a Marinol School of Theology in Ossining, New York, for a year of reflection, and there he wrote a book about his experiences in the Philippines and his personal struggle to find a Christian way to oppose violent oppression. The book is titled Revolution from the Heart. It's published by the Oxford University Press. By the way, he returned to the Philippines 10 months ago, after Marcos was overthrown and Corazon Aquino had become president. Father O'Brien, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good evening.
You arrived in the Philippines during the early stages of Vatican II, and it meant coping with all the changes in the church at the same time that you were coping with a completely different culture. And one of the things that you realized after a while in the Philippines was that the primary need in the island where you were wasn't just prayer, it was community. Would you explain that?
Well, with regard to the Vatican Council, of course, I was very excited. I took to it like a duck to water. And immediately I got involved in all the changes of the liturgy into the local language and got myself involved in it. But it also, another thing began to impinge on me, and that was the terrific suffering of the people. Of course, my attitude, even Vatican Council in the early days, didn't seem to talk too much about the poor, actually. It talked about being closer to the world, but it didn't talk about being closer to the poor. But gradually it came across to me that a lot of prayer with no justice is the best formula for atheism in the next generation. And I just felt that without justice, we were wasting our time.
Now, did the Philippines you were working with agree with that or understand it? Because at a lot of the meetings that you went to, everyone would say that their primary need was for a chapel. And there wasn't this sense of organizing Christian communities.
Yes, that took us quite a while to get this point across. And I found that my early days of having a great devotion to the traditional devotions of the church, which I still appreciate, that helped me because I did understand the people's need for prayer. My companions sometimes would be rather paternalistic about this and would feel that the people were wasting their time. On one particular occasion, we were running this seminar and we were asking the people what their needs were. And we were trying to discover their felt needs. Of course, we wanted them to tell us, really, that that their needs were proper wages, schooling, health. And they kept getting up and in rags and saying, we need a chapel, we need a place to pray. Finally, one of the nuns who was with me burst out and said, you don't need a chapel, you need proper wages, you need more food. And I was listening at this time, and just as I overheard her, I suddenly realized that we were manipulating the people. We weren't really listening to them. So we held a meeting, and I said, look, we've just got to start listening to the people. If that's what they say is their need, we've got to hear what they say. Now, strangely enough, when we did accept their need, that they wanted a chapel, that they wanted to build a chapel, well, it turned out that the act of building that chapel and collecting together the grass and the reeds and the bamboos necessary was a magnificent act of community and the ideal act for entering into the whole area of community and an ideal act for beginning what we were looking for.
I want you to explain the kinds of communities that you were creating in the Philippines.
I'll explain by telling you a little story.
Sure.
One time a group came into the convento after our communities were going quite well, and a group came into the convento and said to me, would we start a small Christian community in their area? Now, at this time, I was in the upper hand because everybody wanted to start them. So I said, well, look, Let me first of all tell you what a small Christian community is. You see this roof, I said. The grass for this roof I got from a man, a strong man who lives way out in a place called Nasalayan. Now, he came in to me the other day about a year after bringing in the grass, and he carried his wife on his back. And as he was walking along the 8 miles that he came in, he had a little child running beside him, holding onto his trousers, and another child carrying a third child. And he came in the 8 miles in the tropical sun. And he told me, he delivered his wife to the door, and she was just a bag of bones. And he looked about 20 years younger than her. And he said to me, he said that they had nothing at all in their house, and that they didn't even have a pillow, and at night time, because she found it so hard to sleep, he would stretch out his arm like that, and she would sleep on it the whole night. I don't know why he told me that little detail, but it remained with me. And I said to the people, I said, you know, if there had been a Christian community in that village, the men of the community would have carried his wife in on a hammock. The women of the community would have looked after the children and fed them while they went in. And the people of the community would have collected a little money and got some medicine long ago. I said, that's what being a Christian community means. When there's a Christian community, you can lie down at night knowing, I can lie down at night in peace, knowing that old people are being visited, sick people are being helped, and the poor are being fed. And that's what a Christian community is.
You had a revelation that you put down in your book about the time that you started organizing this Christian communities. You wrote that poverty can be born with patience, but not oppression. That oppression, dealing with oppression, is very different than dealing with poverty.
Yes, you see, poverty, somehow other people can say this is the will of God. They can say that I don't have as much as you have, or that you've got a bigger house than I have. But oppression, injustice means that you feel the sense that it's been taken off you by somebody unjustly. Quite different from something losing it just by an act of fate. Though actually our bishop recently, I heard him say this, and it's germane to what you're saying. Our bishop, Bishop Fortage, he's the man who's had a grenade thrown at him recently. He said that poverty, he says, some people say the poor you'll have always with you. And the bishop says, yes, I can understand that. Some people have a big car, some have a small and some have none at all. Some have a large house, some have a small house. I can understand that they'll always be poor. But destitution, no, he said. People lacking the very necessities of life, that's not the will of God. That was never in God's plan. And I think it's important to make that distinction between poverty and destitution, between poverty which is unnecessary and poverty which is caused by the greed of others.
This is the kind of thing you really had to work with the people in your communities. For instance, you describe women coming to you with dead babies who they wanted you to bless, and you'd say, well, what killed them? Why did they die? And instead of saying, well, malnutrition or lack of medical care, they'd say, it was the will of God, and this would very much upset you.
Yes, I got, you know, sometimes the sheer total lethargy which had come into the culture, that people would say, this is the will of God. And I would just say quite simply, this is not the will of God. God wants all of us to finish out our years and to go into the grave filled with years and having seen our children's children. And this isn't the will of God. And I must say at that time I had quite a temptation I had an admiration for those who had gone to the mountains and joined the New People's Army, for example, because they at least were standing up. They at least had broken the passivity. And so we spent a lot of time trying to wake people up from the idea that their circumstances were the will of God, were caused by them, and therefore one shouldn't work to change them.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the New People's Army. Now, this was an army of people who decided to fight the Marcos regime with arms. You have always been against violence. You've been for nonviolent. Then you were for nonviolent ways of overthrowing Marcos. What would you say to young men who would tell you that they were going to pick up arms and join the New People's Army to try to end the kind of oppression that they were suffering under?
Oh boy, that wasn't easy because they could easily say back to me, well, what are you doing about it? Because I would admit, if you look at any, if you look at the situation in a place like the Philippines or in many other places, there are only two visible reactions at the moment. Passivity, which encourages the oppression and encourages the suffering and the injustice, and is the most common reaction, passivity. And then counter-violence, people standing up and hitting back. And strangely enough, Gandhi says that counter-violence is more dignified than passivity, you know, it's more human. But gradually it was beginning to dawn on me. I knew in my gut that the counter-violence, however justified, it just didn't seem to me to be the thing that Jesus would do. It seemed naive to say that. It seemed being unrealistic. But nevertheless, that was in me. Then eventually, I began to see that there were ways, there were other things. It wasn't just passivity and counter-violence. There was such a thing as active, energetic, assertive, aggressive non-violence, revolutionary non-violence. There were things you could do. And we finally began to do them and to change things without bloodshed.
What was an example of something that you felt you could do that was an assertive act of nonviolence?
Well, there was one particular story where there was a man who was supposed to have killed 27 people in the parish, but certainly he had killed two. And I had reported to the police many times and they'd done nothing about it to capture him and to take him away. And the people were living in terror. And obviously their reaction was going to be call in the revolutionaries and get him shot. And I felt that would be do no good. It would be still looking for the solution outside themselves. They weren't standing up. And of course, in the basic Christian community, we want people to stand on their own two feet, to stand up and to become human through the process of standing up. So we got together and we met all the Christian communities. What are we going to do? And finally, we decided we will go and visit him and we will surround the house and we'll say Mass and we'll invite him to give up his arms. Now, the people would never go on their own. In fact, his house, people used to skirt his house on the road. They wouldn't go near it. So 1,000 of us got together and we came from all directions, a lonely place in the mountains, and arrived at his house. And we said the Mass and I refused him communion and I told him why. And it turned out, of course, that like a child, he handed over all his arms and came with us and gave up what he was doing and told us who was behind him and everything. And I felt it was a terrific victory for over fear, which had governed the people because they felt they could do nothing. They felt the only answer to him was to kill him.
The Catholic, there's a papal statement under Vatican II that said, revolution is justified where there is manifest and long-standing tyranny. Now, how did you interpret that for your circumstances?
That's one of the, it's one of the pieces of church teaching that I have difficulty with, in the sense that it's common sense. It's all the mainline churches, the church, the synagogue, and the mosque all agree that there are circumstances in which I can kill you. I can kill my brother and sister, or I can drop a bomb on a convent of contemplative nuns. I mean, as was happened in Hiroshima. And a priest blessed the plane. But I have difficulty with that for the same gut feeling, naive idea that Jesus just, this isn't the teaching of Jesus. It's the common sense. It's the just war theory. And that came in around about the 3rd century. The early Christian church did not have the just war theory. Even to join the Roman army, you were excommunicated, and soldiers who became Christians, if you remember, would be executed by the because they'd have to leave the army by the Roman authorities. So a lot of the martyrs were soldiers who became Christians. But in the 3rd century, when Constantine sort of co-opted the church into the system and made the bishops sort of princes and part of the empire, then we became part of the defense of the empire. And Augustine developed the just war theory, those occasions in which a Christian would be allowed to kill. He was very much aware that a Christian shouldn't kill. But now there became exceptions. So I have a lot of trouble with that. But as a priest, I feel that a priest should, he has a sacred duty, I think, to give the people the teaching of the church. I mean, I don't think I have a right to come up with some personal opinion and give it to them. So I always said to people, I go for nonviolence. I go for the small Christian communities, and I would take down the Populorum Progressio, and I'd read that little piece that you read. I'd read it, and I translated it into Ilongo, of course. I brought out that encyclical in Ilongo and all the other encyclicals. But then I'd say, look, this is the teaching of the church. If you decide to go to the mountain, you do so without the churches, you are not going against the church. And all I ask you is never have any hate in your heart. But I have chosen a different way. It is a difficult thing, very difficult. I look towards the day when we'll see a gradual disavowment of the just war theory. And I don't think it's that far off.
I want to talk more with you about your work in the Philippines, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Father Neil O'Brien, and he has been based in the Philippines for over 20 years. He was expelled under Marcos, but he went back under Corazon Aquino. He's written a book about his work in the Philippines. It's called Revolution from the Heart. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Father Neil O'Brien is my guest, author of a memoir titled Revolution from the Heart. You started to realize after a while that the kind of basic Christian communities that you were creating were considered very subversive by the Marcos regime. And there's a story you tell in your book, which is the perfect illustration of why they were subversive. And I'd like for you to tell us that story.
Well, you know, my first love is the liturgy. And I got so involved in that actually I was, at one early stage, I was sent letters from Rome in Latin, very formal, asking me to do some experiments with the ceremony of baptism and send my experiment results of my experiments. So I rewrote the baptism service many times. And eventually, as time went on, I began to realize that baptism is at its heart a challenge to people to change the structures, to change the structures of the world. Quite different from the TV evangelist sort of idea that the world is in a terrible place, let's get out of it and to hell with everybody else. Baptism calls us to change the world. Admit it's in a bad state, but to change it. So those famous promises of baptism, I think they're in all, most ceremonies have them. Do you renounce Satan with all his works and with all his pomps? And, I decided that people didn't know what those works and pomps were. Let's name the works and pomps. So I had, do you renounce militarization? Do you renounce hunger? Do you renounce torture? And all the things that were happening round about us, I asked people, do you renounce them? And then I would come up with the other ones. Are you willing to stand up and help people who are suffering? Are you willing to stand by those who are being oppressed? Are you willing to oppose injustice? And one day I was giving a mass in the next diocese in a lonely mountain place. And in the middle of the mass, I was, mainly there were mainly women at this mass, and I was in the middle of the sermon when I noticed over the half walls of the little church that we were surrounded by troops in fatigues with machine guns, and the machine guns at the semi-ready. Suddenly I gave a deep breath, and everybody in the church sort of froze. And I went blank. I said, what did I say last? Couldn't. I knew that I had been possibly talking about torture or about militarization or something like that. So then I said, I noticed there are a lot of women here in the church today. And I said, you know, at the first mass, all the apostles ran away. Only the women remained. Now, they were surrounded by Roman soldiers, armed Roman soldiers, and I'm sure they were afraid. And I'm sure it was quite subversive for them to be in open sympathy with somebody who was a criminal. But they stuck there and they stayed it out in spite of those armed soldiers. And of course, I became like a broken record, but they were getting the message. And as I spoke, the soldiers were moving in. And by the time it came to the end of the Mass, they were right in and looking over the half walls. And I came to the baptism. It was the baptism at the end of the Mass. So I started the baptism, and when I got to the part, do you renounce militarization? Do you renounce injustice? Do you renounce? I don't know what happened, but I suddenly found the words wouldn't come out of my mouth. I said, do you renounce Satan and all his works and all his pomps? And everybody dutifully said yes. Well, to make a long story short, afterwards, when we finally got out of that mess, I was coming home and I said to myself, why did I change? And then I realized I changed because I was afraid. I changed because what I was saying was subversive. And then I said to myself, you know, true religion should be subversive in the sense that it should want to subvert the unjust structures which stop us being the brothers and sisters which we are supposed to be if there is a God as a parent of us all, you know.
Well, you certainly succeeded in being seen as subversive by the Marcos regime. You were not long after this incident happened rounded up, placed under arrest on trumped-up charges of having killed a local mayor, and a deal, after over a year in prison, a deal was cut that they would drop the charges if you left the country. And you did, but you came back after Marcos was overthrown. And I'd like to talk with you now about what life is like under Corazon Aquino and if it's changed at all. First of all, are conditions any better? Is day-to-day life any better on the island of Negros?
No, day-to-day life. Well, there's not the fear is gone in many areas. There is not so much fear as there was in the days of Marcos. And there was certainly, and I would say still is, a lingering hope for change. But the day-to-day life has not changed. But that does not alarm me. I don't expect, after 20 solid years of Marcos digging this enormous hole, that she can fill it up in 18 months. I really think it's unrealistic and it's a fairy tale-like understanding of the way the world works to think that she could do that. She's done three magnificent things. She's got him out. She's put in a constitution. She's had what was an election, which even if it wasn't 100% honest, was certainly the most honest we've had in the history of the Philippines. So with that, she has laid the foundations for what could be a stumbling towards democracy.
When you returned to the Philippines, you saw signs up in different places saying, do not support priests and nuns who are communists.
Yes, the military, of course, see the changes as very adverse to them. And they want to get rid of Corazon Aquino with all their heart. So hence all the coups. And they also see the church as a fiscalizer. As the church, of course, changed. For many years, the church was very much on the side of the landowners long ago. But the church has changed. Our bishop now, who comes from a landowning family, now he has stood up for land reform and he's had a grenade thrown at him and his palace burnt down. So, and that we were receiving letters, threats, which say, you know, your days are numbered. And so there's a terrific attack on the priests, and especially any priest who speaks about justice or about land reform. So that has made it very difficult for us at the moment.
Now, another thing that you've noticed about life now under Aquino is that the word nonviolence and all the language of nonviolence has been corrupted by its use from who? From the military.
Well, lots of people who don't want change grab the word nonviolence because it seems to them that what they really mean is they don't want any change.
Who are you talking about?
Oh, I'd say it's the military and I'd say the landowners. They sort of say, well, we're against violence. What they mean is we're against the violence of the revolutionaries, but they don't seem to be against the violence of the system, which means that a very wealthy island has thousands and thousands of 100,000 children lining up for soup kitchens to get free soup sent in by generous people in other parts of the world.
And so in their mouths, you think that the words nonviolence really means passivity, acceptance?
It means passivity and acceptance. That means that the nonviolence then becomes a dirty word.
So that puts you in a funny position because you, as you always have, still support nonviolence, but the language of nonviolence is now distrusted by people who think that it's come to mean passivity and acceptance. So what can you do to kind of get the language back?
You've got to rescue the words and you've got to struggle for it. You've got to struggle to change. But I'll tell you this much. When you examine on violence, you see, you for example, people will often laugh at the idea of turning the other cheek. But you look at the expression, if he strikes you in one cheek, turn the other. It is
it is an attack on the conscience and the heart of the person who has struck you. It's like saying to them, look, I believe you're a human being. Don't act like a brute. I'm giving you the choice. Make a choice again to hit me or not. So you're really a fierce attack on the conscience and the heart. Now, that turning the other cheek is anything but passivity. It is a confronting of the evil.
It must feel ironic to you that Aquino, who is able to come in to power in an incredibly peaceful overthrow, now has to use violence sometimes to stay there.
Well, she has been. It has been really forced on her. I mean, there is a revolution from the left. There is this army which is intoxicated with the power it got. Like, did you ever give a cat meat instead of milk and he'll never go back to the milk? You know, the army doesn't want to go back to the milk, and there's no way they want to give up. So to me, the two extremes live off each other, and she's in the center.
Are you going to stay in the Philippines? You were not born into that life of poverty, and you could leave at some point. How much longer do you think you'll want to stay?
I hope I want to stay always.
So you're committed to staying in the Philippines?
Well, yes. I had a chance to make a change when I was expelled that time, and to change to another mission or maybe to work at home. But somehow or other, I felt that, you know, I feel that where people are crying out for life, where people are calling, God is the God of life. So what people are calling out for life, they're calling out for God. If you're close to them, you'll be close to God in some way. So if I'm staying on there, it's for my own sake, because I feel that they are my key to holiness.
It reminds me of something you say in the book, which is that you realized you didn't have to be the model Christian and offer yourself as the example of perfection. You would learn as much from them as they're from you.
Yes, that has been one of the most beautiful things, to discover that they are the ones evangelizing us. You know, and that if I have anything to say here, it's because I've learned it from them.
I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your life in the Philippines. I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, dear.
My guest has been Father Neil O'Brien, who has spent over 20 years now in the Philippines working with the poor on the island of Negros. He was expelled under Marcos, but returned when Corazon Aquino became president. He's written a book about his life and work in the Philippines. It's called Revolution from the Heart, and it's just been published by the Oxford University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.